Jill Whitman, and I am giving the talk on the history of the Cascades and Cascade Mountains. I'm going to start and show some slides and some overheads and various things. Mostly my talk is kind of a show and tell about the area, about the geology in the area, and about some of the recent history. I'm going to have to sneak through here just to go and turn on the projector. And I start with a map of the state of Washington. It's a relief map of the state of Washington. And it highlights to us this Cascade Mountain range as it extends up through this state. Really, the Cascades, and we'll see a map that I show later, the Cascade stretches, in fact, from Northern California all the way up into British Columbia. I think living in the state of Washington, as I do, one is sort of provincial that it's on a mountain range, but in fact, it extends over a much greater distance. The Cascades were initially named by Lewis and Clark on an expedition when they came down the Columbian River rapids and named the mountains after the Cascades, or the rapids that were in that river. So the Cascades doesn't so much have anything to do with the mountain range itself, but really with what was going on in the river. Now, the highest peaks in the Cascades reach up somewhere slightly over 14,000 feet, and the highest peaks in the lower 48 states are only slightly higher than that. And yet, I think to anyone who has seen the Rockies and compared them with the Cascades, there's something very dramatic about the tall peaks in the Cascades, because they tend to rise from much lower surrounding topography. And Mount Rainier is probably the perfect example of that. Hood is another very good example, that you look off on the horizon and there's some undulation in the mountain ranges, and then there's this huge peak sticking up. Now, the peaks in the Rockies, which, while they're equally high, are in ranges of mountains that are already up very close to that height. And so the individual peak does not stand out in the same way that the Cascade Mountains do. And that's because of the very different nature of the way that the mountains were formed. Now, basically what we have when we have a volcano is some source of molten material which is making its way to the surface. And there's a couple of different kinds of volcanoes. There's the volcanoes which are very typical of what we find here in the Cascades, and there's other volcanoes which are very different, such as those that we see in Hawaii. But in both cases, there's molten material which is coming from deep within the earth and making its way to the surface. And basically that's what we mean when we say volcano, is sort of this kind of an eruption. I'm going to start, for those of you who may have been here before, it's slightly redundant, but it allows us to sort of lead in to talking about the Cascades themselves by mentioning just briefly this idea of plate tectonics. This is a theory which evolved over the last 30 or so years, which enables us to explain a lot of the features that we see on the Earth. And the basic premise of this theory is that the surface of the Earth, the outer layer of the Earth, can be divided into a series of pieces or plates which move relative to one another. And this is a map that then shows the different plates on the surface of the Earth. You can see the outlines of the continents for reference. Here's North America. And you can see that the names of these plates, if you can make them out from there, are related to geographic features on those plates or to some name within that plate. The Pacific plate then occupying much of the Pacific Ocean basin. The South American plate, including the continent of South America. But the South American plate is a very good example that shows us that these plates, the boundaries of them, the limits of these plates, has nothing to do with continent versus ocean. So that we have a whole piece slab of material which is moving as one rigid unit here in the South American plate, which includes both continental crust here and the oceanic crust as well, all moving together. Now, what we have is a couple of chairs. Apparently the chairs all vanished next door at the previous lecture time. So now maybe they need to make their way back. I'm not sure. But what we have is these plates moving relative to one another, and so at the edges of these plates we then have the plate boundaries. We can outline the plates by these plate boundaries. Plate boundaries are where things happen in terms of geology. It's where there are volcanoes. It's where there are earthquakes. And we have plate boundaries where the plates are moving apart, such as this boundary here between the Antarctic and Pacific plate, or here in this ocean basin between North American and Europe, and North American and Africa, and South American and Africa, and so on. We also have places where the plates are then moving together. If we have places where the plates are moving apart, In order to keep the Earth a constant size, they must be coming back together. You may want to check and see if you can get some from next door.
Okay.
And it's where the plates are coming together that we have what we call a convergent plate boundary. And if we look just briefly on this map, and then we're going to zoom in on this area, we can see that we have the Pacific plate, we have a very small plate here called the Juan de Fuca plate, and the North American plate, and our Cascades then sit right here in this region. And this overhead is then a blow-up of the west coast of North America, Pacific plate, Juan de Fuca plate, and North American plate. The third type of plate boundary which exists is that where two plates simply slide past one another, and that is the kind of a plate boundary that we have here at the San Andreas. But what we have here along this margin of the southern part of British Columbia, state of Washington, Oregon, and Northern California is our convergent plate boundary where two plates are coming back together. And this is then a cross-section that shows us what that convergent plate boundary looks like. Well, once the two plates converge, we can't then have material from two plates occupying the same place. And so what happens instead is that one of these plates bends and goes down beneath the other plate. And this plate here, which contains the oceanic crust of the Juan de Fuca plate, is then bending down or subducting beneath the North American plate. Well, this material on the oceanic plate includes the rocks which make up the oceanic crust and sediments which overlie them, have a lot of water in them. And as this plate goes down, this material is then going back down into deeper parts of the Earth where it's hotter, and material starts to melt. And so what we do is produce volcanoes above it as the material in this subducting plate melts and is lighter and then makes its way back up to the surface. So just to put ourselves in this context then, we have this convergent plate boundary, we have oceanic crusts being subducted beneath North America here, and as a result, when that oceanic crust is subducted, it melts and it forms volcanoes up above. And that explains a lot of what we see here in terms of the geology of the Cascades. But there's also something else that happens in that sometimes these plates, as they come in, are carrying small pieces of continent on them. Continental crust is very light and it doesn't subduct. And so we'll see in a later diagram that sometimes we can add material onto the continent that is being carried along on this plate here. And we'll talk about how that fits in to the story of the Cascades as well. If we look, in fact, at the west coast of North America, a number of scientists have spent a lot of time looking at the rocks which are found on the west coast of North America and studying the fossil record which is present primarily, and some of what has become a very useful tool in geology recently, which is to use magnetic evidence preserved in the rocks. And they've discovered that there are separate blocks that make up not only the west coast of the U.S., but all the way up through Canada and back into Alaska. And these separate blocks do not all have the same history to them. Fossils are very good at telling us what latitude material came from. If you think in today's setting, we have corals in the tropical regions. And if we find a block of rock which contains corals up in Alaska at the present time, but in rocks which are 200 million years old, we have a pretty good basis to say that those rocks must have been in a tropical region at the time that those rocks were formed. In order to have coral in them, there must have been the right temperature setting in order for that material to grow. And so the study of fossils here tells us that these different blocks have different histories to them. You can see that there's on the order of 30 or so different what we call terrains, and it's spelled differently from terrain as in the surface of the Earth. The word which is often used is this terrain, T-E-R-R-A-N-E, to talk about these blocks which have been added on. And we see that there's many separate ones, and they all seem to have come from different areas and been added onto the west coast of North America. So at some time earlier on in North American history, the edge of the continent came here along this boundary of the Brown, and then this material has been added on over probably the last 200 million years or so. Well, in particular, the one which will be of interest to us later on in this story is this small little block here, which is labeled CA, which somehow in somebody putting together this little key, they neglected to tell us what CA was. CA happens to be the Cascades block. And what this is a small block of material which has been added on here in the northern part of the Cascades, and we'll come back and look at that as well. And just to look at this kind of an idea in cross-section, this is a diagram that comes from a paper of some people who have studied this area. What we had is this subduction zone, and this was then the continent of North America. And we had this block, which was riding in, a microcontinent, this light material, which was too light to be subducted, riding on this plate. And as this plate made its way to the subduction zone, the continental material was not able to be subducted because it was too light, and so it just sort of added on. It scrunched, folded, deformed, whatever was in between, but now the continent, in essence, extended out into here. And there's some complexity that there may have been two subduction zones, but you can see that after this block has been added onto the previous continent, now the subduction would take place out to the west of this block. And so if we were to look back at this, the previous diagram, presumably we've had a series of subduction zones, and after a block gets added on, the subduction zone moves a little bit to the west, and we add another block and the subduction zone moves, and so on. So this will give us then a little bit of a setting as we move in to look at the North Cascades a little bit later on. It turns out that this Cascades block itself was probably rocks that were somewhere on the order of 400 to 200 million years old, which have been added on. They probably weren't added on to North America until 50 million years ago. So it was a block of continental material which was making its way across the Pacific before it was added on. The type of rocks that we find here in the North Cascades are really quite different from what we find in the southern part of the Cascades, and that then will show up here in terms of what we see in some of the slides that I'll show from this area. If we look at the Cascades themselves, and this map is then just showing us the peaks, the big peaks of the Cascades, and putting the names on them, we can see that the Cascades basically extend from Lassen here in the northern part of California all the way up to Garibaldi in southern British Columbia. Yeah?
Can I back up just a bit?
Mm-hmm.
If all these different pieces of continental crust have come from someplace, it's hard for me to picture that with that one big Pacific plate sort of holding everything together, and then North American, like, how is there room for these separate pieces to move in?
Well,
are there
the
Pacific plate?
There pieces were on a plate.
Okay.
The plate wasn't the Pacific plate, because the Pacific plate, in the past, there was another plate between the Pacific plate and the North American plate. Because the Pacific plate's in essence actually moving away west, is that way. The Pacific plate is moving away from North America, really. But there was a plate which was a much larger plate, the Juan de Fuca is just a small remnant of it, which was coming towards North America. And a good example when you try to think of these little microcontinents and to put them into present day setting is to think of the area of Indonesia. There's all these sort of very large islands. Many of them are associated with the subduction zone over there, and they're lighter material, and so if we were to start pushing those toward a continent, either towards Australia or upwards towards Asia, we would be adding them on to Asia or Australia rather than putting them down the subduction zone. And New Guinea is a very good example of that. New Guinea's been up in the north of the tropics for quite a while, and Australia's basically been making its way towards New Guinea, and those two will at some time in the future geologically become a single continent. In fact, today, the water never goes down to the depths that we find in the open ocean between Australia and New Guinea. They've already started to coalesce into one.
I have a question.
Yeah?
Is the Mount Baker on your map? Bachelor. In Oregon?
I don't know.
Because it's between Mount Hood and the Three Sisters. It's in that area.
I don't know the answer to that. But you know, it doesn't show up so much to mention the book, which shows up in the bookstore, which deals a lot with this. It doesn't really show up as much as being considered to be part of the Cascades. Is it a little further east?
It is further east.
And I think its origin is different then.
Oh.
If we look at the Cascades today, they are all inland of the edge of the continent. And really, the Cascades are a pair of mountain ranges. We have what we call the Western Cascades, and we have what we call the High Cascades. And the Western Cascades are another range of mountains, lower mountains, not active volcanically today, which run up through this region and not up here to the Olympics. But they're particularly noticeable out here in Western Oregon. And these Western Cascades were formed by a similar process to what we have today, where there was subduction and volcanism, but it took place much longer ago, about 40 million years ago. Repeated cycles of material, which was erupted and then eroded, and more material erupted and added onto the top and then eroded. And then what we had was something changing in the scenario so that the volcanism moved slightly eastward in the whole process. And then we have built the new range of the High Cascades on top of the material from this older range. And a cross section here of Mount Rainier gives us sort of this idea. Here we have this underlying rock, which is shown by all this sort of hatched pattern down here. And this is material left over from the formation of the Western Cascades about 40 million years ago. And then on top of it, in a much more recent series of eruptions, we've produced Mount Rainier. And the volcanism didn't really start in the High Cascades, in the present-day mountain range, until about 7 million years ago, and most of it, in fact, has taken place since 2 million years ago. So much older rock, which was eroded down to a much flatter surface, and then on top of that, we've added these new volcanoes. And so when we look at our Cascade Range today, where we see sort of the lower range of mountains and peaks, those are the remnants of the old Western Cascades, and then superimposed on that are our very dramatic peaks that we have, such as Hood and what was once Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier and so on. A lot of eruptions have taken place over the last 2 million years throughout the entire Cascade Range. What I'm really going to focus on is looking at the mountains that make up the Cascades today and talk a little bit about the recent history of these, to talk about the recent volcanic history, and then by the time that we get up into the northernmost ones, and I'm going to be terribly provincial and only deal with those that are in the U.S. In part, that's because I don't have a picture of Garibaldi to stick into the thing. But by the time we work up into this region, I'll also spend a little bit of time talking about glaciation and what effect that has had on the shape of the mountain range up here as well. All of the historic eruptions which have occurred in the United States, in the lower 48 states, in the last hundreds of years in terms of historic eruptions have all taken place in the Cascades. Now we know as we look around the United States there are areas where there has been recent, in terms of geology, has been recent volcanism down in the area near Flagstaff, for example. You can see some fairly young looking volcanoes, but none of them have occurred in historic time, and that unfortunately is the perspective of the white man's historic time in this continent. So everything in the last 300 years or so, but in fact probably only in the last 150 or 200, has occurred out here in the Cascade Range. Now, there's a lot of terms which get used to describe volcanoes. We talk about extinct volcanoes, we talk about dormant volcanoes, and probably these volcanoes do not deserve either of those terms. These are certainly not extinct volcanoes. These are probably not even dormant volcanoes. Dormant means that they're sleeping. These are simply inactive volcanoes, and some of them have been active more recently than others, Mount St. Helens as the example that we're all familiar with. And so we bring that up sort of as a reminder that some of us may live closer to one than another. We may think that we live in sort of this nice little shadow of a safe volcano, but they're probably just inactive volcanoes. Well, what I'm going to do is start here and work upwards from Lassen, talk about some of the things which show up in the geologic record of these different mountains. If we start down here in the region of Mount Lassen, we're actually standing on an area on sort of the northwestern flank of the mountain. You can drive up to this, you can see a road here in the foreground. And Lassen has been one of the volcanoes most recently active in the Cascades, other than Mount St. Helens. We're far enough south here at Lassen Peak, we're only at an elevation, maximum elevation of a little over 10,000 feet, far enough south that we don't have any glaciers on this mountain, but we certainly have snow. And this picture was taken in April, and so you can see the snow has persisted. In 1914, 1915, and on into 1916, Mount Lassen was active. There were lava flows in this region. But one of the more dramatic things which occurred was a mud flow. To some of you who may have heard me talk yesterday, I spent some time talking about mud flows. Basically, what we mean by a mud flow is loose debris from clay size, sand size, pebbles, and on up into very big rocks and boulders, which are suspended in material with water in it. And this happens a lot of times. Mudslides are similar to mud flows. This happens in the wet season that we have, even on the west side of the Cascades. But it's a common thing which can happen in a volcano, particularly if there's an eruption. Two things occur in the case of an eruption. One is that there's a lot of heat coming up to the surface. And so if we have a snow cover on the mountain, all of a sudden we're going to have a very large amount of water. And two, in that eruption, we will often release a lot of loose material. And this loose material will then get mixed with that water and will flow as a mud flow. And what in fact happened here in 1915 was, after a series of lava flows and eruptions of ash, a huge mud flow came out of this side of the mountain and flowed down in this pattern and then on down sort of along the path of the present-day road. This area was devastated. It was under many feet of this mud debris. And even further down the road towards the west were bunch of students that we were taking out in the field are now all standing on top of what the region which is called the Chaos Jumbles. And basically, this is what was left after the water went on its way. These were the blocks of material which had been carried along and deposited. And you can see by looking at the people that some of them are really quite large. And we'll talk a little bit later about mud flows and another volcano. Since these eruptions, Lassen has been fairly inactive. There was the eruption of a small cinder cone about 150 years ago, which also has built up some of Mount Lassen. If we come up to further north to Mount Shasta, the geologic record suggests that Mount Shasta has erupted on the order of every 800 years or so. The last significant eruption in this area was about 200 years ago. And so if we were to sort of look at it statistically, perhaps Mount Shasta isn't due for an eruption in the too near the future. Now, Shasta, again, is one of the taller volcanoes, reaching up to about 14,000 feet. Moving on up into perhaps one of the more dramatic mountains, which is no longer present in the Cascades, is that the mountain which was named Mount Mazama. And Indian legend has certainly talked about the eruption of this volcano. Mount Mazama was a mountain built by a series of volcanic eruptions over about a 2-million-year time. And then 6,600 years ago, this mountain blew its top in very much the same way that Mount St. Helens blew its top. And this artist's rendition then shows us what this mountain looks like after the top blew off. A lot of ash and material was blown out of this mountain. And in fact, somewhere on the order of 10 cubic miles of material was blown out of the top of this mountain when it erupted. Since it sits in the same region as Mount St. Helens, this material was blown eastward across the United States, and the distance over which this ash fell was into the states all the way to the east coast of the United States. So this was a huge eruption. This pit, which was then left in the top of the mountain, is called a caldera geologically. That's because of the size of it. It's on the order of 5 miles across, close to 2,000 feet deep. And the term which is used to name this mountain today is what?
Crater.
But that's a misnomer. Craters are very small pits, not 5 miles. And in fact, Crater Lake ought to be called Caldera Lake, but we know that we'll never change that geologically. And since 6,600 years ago, Crater Lake this mountain has experienced further eruptions to make the small little cinder cone which sits in the middle of it. And a cinder cone is simply a pileup of ash-like material which is then blown out of a vent. And so we can see that even though this mountain has not experienced anything as great as the eruption of 6,600 years ago, it still has continued to have activity. And I unfortunately don't really know the age of Wizard Island other than it's younger than 6,600 years. Has anybody here been down into Crater Lake? A couple people have. The first time that I went to Crater Lake, a friend of mine had said to me, hike down and ride the boat. And I said, oh yeah, I'm going to go to a national park, and I'm going to hike down, and I'm going to ride the boat like every other person at that national park does. It's worth it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was one of the most spectacular things I have ever done at a national park. The boat takes you down and sort of does a circle inside the lake. It's about a mile hike or so down to the boat, and then a mile hike back up. On a fairly steep trail. But it was really a worthwhile expedition, and I can't remember exactly where it shows up here. I think it's in this region. You can get off on Wizard Island and hike up on the Cinder Cone, and then they'll take you back on another boat that comes in later on. So, for those of you who ever have the opportunity to go to this region, it is truly worth going down the lake. Yeah.
You have to look for the old man of the lake also, that floating log.
Oh, the floating log, that's right. This is really an incredible lake. Just a lot of my training is in oceanography, and from the standpoint of lake ecosystems, it's really spectacular. It is incredibly pure water in this lake. And they tell people that if they get seasick on the boat, that they have to use the buckets on the boat, because they don't want anything to end up in this lake that didn't end up there naturally. But truly a worthwhile experience. Now, moving further northwards, passing over some of the other ones, I don't have pictures of them. Newberry Caldera is one which is a very interesting mountain. I haven't personally been there, so unfortunately I have no picture. But again, it is a caldera. It is one where the top was blown off of the mountain. And Newberry is one where there is still a source of heat beneath that caldera. And it has been tapped, and people would like to see it tapped even more as a geothermal resource. Because one of the things that we have when we have these mountains is this heat coming up into them as a resource. And a lot of exploration, in fact, in Crater Lake in the last few years has been trying to see if there are any hot springs which are seeping into the bottom of this lake. But Newberry sits off to the east of many of the Cascades, and it's kind of a unique setting compared to some of the others. Moving on up to Mount Hood. Again, Mount Hood is one which, it was a slightly hazy picture that I have here, but taken across the city of Portland. Mount Hood, like Mount Rainier, dominates the skyline for the city, and it sticks up from what you can see are very low, by comparison, surrounding mountains. These are the ancient mountains from eruptions tens of millions of years ago. By the time we come up to Mount Hood, there are some glaciers on this mountain. And I'm not going to start talking about glacial features here, but when we talk about the glacial features on some of the more northerly mountains, you can think about some of the similar consequences for down here. Interesting that on geologic terms, not on historic terms, but over tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, Mount Hood seems to be in sequence with Mount St. Helens, and that their eruptions have occurred fairly close together on some sort of an interval similar interval between the two. Now, Mount Hood hasn't been active recently, but we all know that Mount St. Helens certainly has been. Moving further north, a picture of Mount Adams.
Jill, what would be the reason for that? Why would there be that connection?
Ha! Wouldn't we like to know that? We would all love to know that. As simply residents of the area, as geologists, we would desperately love to know that. It's a very difficult thing to understand why there are sort of these pulses of volcanism that take place in these settings. And I don't think we really understand that. We'd love to be able to answer that. We'd love to be able to tell any one of us, people who would ask, you know, when a volcano is going to erupt next. They're not too far apart. Maybe something is happening along that segment of the subduction zone, which is sort of pulsing for both of those mountains at the same time. Unfortunately, can't answer that. But as we come up further north, this is the old Fujiyama of North America. This is a picture of Mount St. Helens before the eruption. And this is just a perfect example of the type of volcanoes which occur in these type of settings geologically. The volcanoes of the Hawaiian Islands are produced by a very different kind of process. And if anybody's ever been there, you realize that the peaks really are not magnificent peaks. They tend to be, they're what we call shield volcanoes, and they have a very gently curving surface to them, and it's usually a concave surface. In contrast, the sides of these volcanoes, which we call stratovolcanoes, are ones which have convex surfaces to them and very magnificent peaks. And that's in part related to the type of material which is coming out in the volcanoes. The material that comes out in a Hawaiian volcano is one which flows very easily. And so it flows down, making these very Now, Mount St. Helens had sat there very quietly for a long time, although geologically, people had certainly come to expect that this was one of the most active volcanoes around. Predictions made in 1978 by a couple of scientists at the United States Geological Survey said, if any volcano is going to blow, it's going to be Mount St. Helens. That didn't make people move away, because it didn't really make it out into the popular literature. The press is never very popular if they take and print things like that.
Why did they think that it would blow?
Based on the record of the intervals at which it had erupted. Not that they thought it was going to blow, but that they thought it would be active. They didn't make any predictions about the size of what the activity would take place, but that there had been activity over the past thousands of years on sort of a repeated kind of a cycle, and so the likelihood was that that would happen once again.
Before you go on, could you sort of draw with a finger what part of that mountain was blowing off?
I'm going to show you a picture.
Okay.
Okay, some familiar pictures to people who have seen anything of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. This picture is then taken from the north and slightly eastward. Looking at the north side, I have to tell you that one of the reasons I couldn't answer in that slide was that I don't know what direction that picture was taken from. This one, I know what direction it was taken from. So we're looking at the north side of the volcano, and it is then the north side of the mountain which is blowing out at this point. This was one of the early phases of the eruption, and then later on in the same day, we had this very tall ash plume of material which was being ejected vertically to a distance of about 15 miles. Now, the next picture then shows us what the shape of the mountain was beforehand and what the shape of the mountain is afterwards. And this is looking in then from the north side, and you can see this huge crater which is left after the mountain has blown in this direction. The interesting thing is that this was an enormous event in terms of North America and people being aware of it, and yet only a third of a cubic mile of material was blown out of the mountain in this event. And remember that the number that I gave for Mount Mazama in our present-day Crater Lake is 10 cubic miles. And yet there have been eruptions and calderas produced by huge blows much, much greater than this. Krakatoa is one, which was very large. Yellowstone is actually sitting in a very old caldera that was somewhere on the order of 10 to 100 times larger than that of Crater Lake. So this kind of thing does happen geologically. We just happen to have witnessed a small scale, but nonetheless very dramatic one, which took place back in 1980.
Is there any reason why there is a lake at Crater Lake and there's no lake here?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? Time will certainly be one way to answer that question. I don't know what all of the source of the water is at Crater Lake. One problem is that the way we fill up a lake is that we have rivers running into it. Lake Chelan is a perfect example. I mean, it's fairly closed off basin here, and we have a lot of rivers which flow down into it. Here, the only water that's going to flow down into it has to have fallen on this side of the ridge, because anything that falls on this side of the ridge is going to run out of it. And so it almost makes me wonder if in the case of Crater Lake, there is some underwater source of seepage. This is still a very warm and active area, so the water wouldn't tend to stay around. So that doesn't answer your, doesn't give you a firm answer, but my speculation on the whole thing. Now, remember another very dramatic part of what happened in the blow of Mount St. Helens was just the flattening of material. Again, we're looking in from the north side at the crater which resulted from this mountain blowing. And this area was where all of the trees are flattened. And some of what I'm going to talk about tomorrow when I give a talk is looking in some more detail at what remains in this area after the blast, and in fact what has come back slightly greater than 11 years later. Now, as we move on to the rest of the mountains north of Mount St. Helens, we come into an area where glaciers play a very large role in sculpting the topography. And glaciers are a system of moving ice. Glaciers can flow sort of anywhere from centimeters a day to occasionally to tens of meters a day. And basically what drives a glacier is that we have snow this is a picture that just shows some of what has grown back in this area after the blast. this is a glacier in Alaska. We can see that the ice is moving, flowing in this direction. It has tributaries in the same way that rivers do, small side glaciers which flow in and add material to a very large glacier. And what we have is a greater accumulation of ice than the melting, which takes place, and then by the time we come down to the toe of the glacier, the melting is happening at a more rapid pace than the supply of ice upslope. There are two major types of glaciers in the world. There are those which we call valley glaciers, such as this, flowing in valleys between peaks. There are also ice caps. And Greenland and Antarctica are present-day ice caps that we have, dramatic ice caps. There are some small ice caps other places in the world. But those are the two that we're quite familiar with. In just a little bit, I'll talk about the fact that much of the area where we are today was covered by an ice cap in past history. Now, the valley glaciers usually are found in high mountain valleys. Today we find them in the Alps, in the Himalayas, in our very tall mountains. We see a lot of them in Alaska, and we will also see that there, at the present time, are still many in the state of Washington. Continental glaciers are of a much greater extent, and they're much flatter features, not in valleys. Antarctica has a lot of seawater, however, or water stored in that glacier, and if that ice cap were to melt off of Antarctica, we might rise sea level on the order of 60 meters, which is somewhere on the order of maybe 130 or 140 feet. That's not an insignificant amount of sea level rise. To those of us who are aware that this potential is going on, we think about some of the environmental issues. Yeah?
What moves the glaciers? Ice is solid. Why'd it go?
Gravity. It's flowing down a slope. Water. Glass is solid. And glass flows. Flows more slowly than ice, but ice moves simply because there's something accumulating on the top and building up and sort of pushing it down under the force of gravity. And it's really kind of interesting. It flows very much like a river does. It flows faster in the middle and slower at the sides. And you go out and you put a bunch of stakes across a glacier here in a straight line and come back at some later time and you'll see sort of this arcuate pattern. And it flows on a time scale that we can actually see. Yeah?
You said 7 meters a day?
No, centimeters. From the on the order of a few centimeters a day to some places it has been measured in sort of pulses of activity of 50 meters, so 160, 70 feet sort of thing. Some of the landforms which are produced by glaciers are quite striking kinds of landforms. One of the most famous kinds of landforms which is produced is that of a U-shaped valley. Yosemite is one of the classic U-shaped valleys. You can see that the shape of the valley is something like this. And that's because glaciers flow over the entire surface of the bottom and they carve out ahead of them and beneath them. Rivers, on the other hand, tend to make V-shaped valleys because they're only carving down where that river is flowing in the bottom of that valley. U-shaped valleys are extremely common in this area. All you have to do is sort of look at the shapes of the valleys here and you'll see that they're U-shaped in cross-section. We were up climbing around up on top of the third level tailings the other day and busy looking down here at the tailings and looking down here at the village and sort of trying to orient ourselves. And then all of a sudden from here you turn and you face west up the valley and in cross-section it's a perfect U. Also, if you're higher up in the village and you look up in this direction, and I don't know the names of all the mountains, but Copper Mountain and those that are to the east of it, you'll see that there's this perfect U-shape as well. And when you get out there again, take a look at that. That is the common signal that says that this area was carved or sculpted by a glacier. But in between the valleys, valley glaciers tend to leave very sharp kinds of peaks. This is a view from someplace in the Cascades. It's just from a textbook, and I don't know what peak in the Cascades. But we can see that here would be our U-shaped valley. Here is the glacier down in here. And here is another glacier on this side, and in between there is this very, very sharp ridge. These ridges are called arêtes. Most of the terms used to describe glaciers come from the Alps, and so most of them are in French. And these very high, bowl-shaped valleys at the tops are called cirques, all sorts of terms that show up when geologists are describing this. But this U-shape in cross-section, and then these very sharp ridges in between, and where you have a whole bunch of glaciers carving away on many different sides of a mountain. You can see sort of here three glaciers worked away, or here in the very famous one of the Matterhorn, we produce features called horns. Again, very sharp peaks where the glaciers have carved away on all the sides of this. You would never get this kind of topography produced by rivers, just by glaciers. So we see these kinds of features worldwide produced by glaciers, and in fact, if we come to this area of North America, we see that there are all sorts of glaciers, these kinds of features which have been produced. Now, I promised that I was going to mention a little bit about what happened longer ago in terms of the history of this region. Somewhere on the order of 2 or 3 million years ago, the northern part of North America was covered by an ice sheet, one of what we call our continental glaciers. You can see this ice sheet here in Greenland was simply a part of a very large ice sheet. It came down here into the United States, covered the area which we now know as the Great Lakes, and in fact, it is these glaciers which produced the landforms of the Great Lakes. And we can see that it also came down into northern Europe and across the northern part of the Soviet Union. And very similar features are found in this region to what we find up here in this region. Now, as I said, this glaciation began about 2 or 3 million years ago. What triggered it is up for great debate geologically, but it has then, since that time, occurred in an on and off kind of phase. And we have times of more extensive glaciation, and we have times of less extensive glaciation. Basically, prior to 3 million years ago, there was no ice up here in the northern hemisphere. And yet today, we still have ice up in some of these regions, and here certainly on Greenland. We are in what we call an interglacial, and every 100,000 years or so, we have a glacial period, and in between that, we have an interglacial. The last maximum in terms of ice cover in North America was about 10,000 years ago, so we got another 90,000 to go, and it's not going to worry any of us. But it is something which has happened on and off throughout the history of the last 2 or 3 million years. And so the glaciers have not completely gone away, they just kind of recede back up and then advance further on. And if we look in just a little bit more detail at the state of Washington, we can see that this ice sheet extended down into the state of Washington, covering the area that we know of today as Puget Sound, covering all of this area where we are today in terms of the North Cascades, and extending out into the eastern part of the state as well. And this ice sheet, as it came down into this area, is very responsible for a lot of the topography that we see in this part of the state. Puget Sound itself is a very deep valley which was carved out by the glaciers. It has then been flooded by seawater as the ocean level has risen when the ice sheets have retreated again. And this is a feature that we call a fjord. We all think of fjords as being things that we find in Scandinavia because the same process, the ice carved out these valleys and then sea level rose and filled the valleys in again. Well, that's exactly what we have here in the case of Puget Sound. We are also very close to a huge valley carved by a glacier. Lake Chelan sits in a valley carved by a glacier. There's another characteristic of Lake Chelan that tells you instantaneously it was carved by a glacier. Does anybody know what the elevation is at the bottom of Lake Chelan? It's below sea level. It's almost 500 feet below sea level. Rivers don't ever carve down below sea level for the most part, because rivers are basically working their way back down to the ocean to return that water. So if you are in an area that's below sea level, it was either carved by a glacier or you've got really complicated kinds of tectonic forces working there. Death Valley and the Dead Sea are two regions where it's not rivers or glaciers that have carved it, but the earth is pulling apart, kind of dropping down in that region. So past glaciation has had its effect in this region, Lake Chelan, Puget Sound. But we also have present-day glaciers that we find in North America, in the North Cascades. The Olympic Mountains have somewhere on the order of 60 active glaciers, some of the largest and healthiest glaciers outside of Alaska, which we find in the United States. Mount Rainier also has a system of glaciers on it, and then up here in the North Cascades, there are still some active glaciers on both Glacier Peak, as the name might suggest, and on Mount Baker. So to then sort of go back to our tour through the Cascades, we'll move northward up to Mount Rainier. This is a picture taken from the south, I believe, of Mount Rainier. And Mount Rainier has not been active in terms of recorded history, human history. The last time Mount Rainier was active was about 6,000 years ago. And the same kinds of things happened here that happened in Lassen at the turn of the century. To go back to my overheads for just a sec, if we look at the present day glacial system on Mount Rainier, we're then looking down at a map view, and we can see that there are on the order of 26 glaciers which are flowing away from the peak. Mount Rainier is the tallest of the Cascades at 14,410 feet, and so we would expect it to have the most glaciers of all the peaks simply because it has the highest elevation. I'm going to show you a couple pictures of a couple of the different glaciers. There are a couple of which are quite easy to go out there and view from simply drive-by areas. The Nisqually is one of these. This is Paradise down in here, and the toe of the Nisqually comes very close down to Paradise. You can see it on the clear day from the observation area. Another one is Evans Glacier, which can be viewed here from the Sunrise area on Mount Rainier. These glaciers then, as they come down to lower elevations, melt and are often the sources for many of the rivers. The Nisqually River flows away from the Nisqually Glacier, as we might expect. If we look back at what was happening on Mount Rainier 10,000 years ago at the glacial maximum, this is then a larger map. The previous map simply covered this kind of area. The black here is then the present-day glacial coverage on Mount Rainier. And we can see by this stippled shading that there was much, much greater glacial coverage around the mountain back 10,000 years ago. And so if we look at the topography, at the landscape, even on the lower reaches of the mountain, we should see evidence of these older glaciers. So this is a picture of the Nisqually Glacier as it comes down toward Paradise. This is a very... You can see this is a very common kind of surface for glaciers. They look very rough on the surface, whereas snow tends to look very smooth. That's because the ice is solid and it pulls away, and there are cracks between these solid blocks, the crevasses that you may have heard about when people talk about glaciers or you read or hear things about them. So you can see that this is the Nisqually coming down in this direction, but in fact, there's evidence of ice coverage in other areas which may be flowing in different directions. This is the Emmons Glacier, the toe of the Emmons Glacier as viewed from Sunrise. These are the low slopes below Sunrise, and you can see the toe of it coming down, flowing down off of a peak which wasn't visible on that day. But again, the crevasses cutting in the ice, indicating that this is a glacier rather than just simply snow coverage. But some of the evidence of past glaciation sort of turned around on a different day and looking the opposite direction, you can see these U-shaped valleys suggesting that glaciers had in fact had reached to lower elevations at some time in the past, and then these very jagged kinds of peaks which are quite typical of the glacial kind of erosion. Well, if we have a volcano that still has a source of heat in it, and Mount Rainier does, there are fumaroles on the surface of Mount Rainier, places where there's sort of steam making its way to the surface. If we have this source of heat and we have all of this water stored up in glaciers, what happens if we put a little bit more source of heat in that mountain? What if we actually have an eruption with all this ice stored there? Well, again, mud flows, but mud flows of a much greater extent than that which occurred in Mount Lassen at the turn of the century. So again, this is looking back, looking here at the present day sort of lava flow extent on Mount Rainier, and these are some of the valleys, river valleys, that flow away from many of these different glaciers on Mount Rainier. And this map is then showing the risk from mud flows in different areas around Mount Rainier. Back about 6,000 years ago, in fact 5,700 years ago, Mount Rainier blew its top, not in anywhere near as dramatic fashion as Mount St. Helens or Crater Lake, but after that eruption, material flowed off on this side and formed what was called the Osceola Mud Flow. The Osceola Mud Flow, this must be in my other, sheet. That is on my other sheet. Covered an area of somewhere on the order of 100 square miles. Since that time, there have been some smaller mud flows which have taken place, but you can see that the risk is certainly very great close to the mountain, but is even fairly significant as we come towards Tacoma and Seattle. And then moving slightly further northwards up to Glacier Peak. Glacier Peak, as its name suggests, has many glaciers on it. We can see this very typical kind of topography produced by the glaciers, the very sharp ridges and the sharp points. And I think I have two slides that show of Glacier Peak. Here, just a little bit closer up to the summit, again, these very sharp ridges. And you can see underlying evidence of the glaciers, which is covered over in this season by snow, but as the snow melts back, that ice will still remain. And then just as a last view, I have a picture of Mount Baker. Again, there are glaciers on Mount Baker. Mount Baker erupted last, Glacier Peak erupted last 12,000 years ago, blowing out a bunch of pumice. And some of you who go walking up through this region may in fact find pieces of that pumice. It covers the countryside in a layer somewhat below the surface, and as it weathers out, it floats down the rivers and so on. Pumice is very distinctive because it's very porous and very light. You pick it up and it's hard to believe it's really a rock. Mount Baker has not had eruptions, but it's had steam coming out of it periodically as recently as 1975. And Mount Baker is considered one which could have a very great threat of mudslides because it's often described as being the one with fire beneath the ice. This region is very different from the southern part of the Cascades, the area of Glacier Peak and Mount Baker. It's a little bit difficult for you all to see this map from a distance. This is basically what geologists make as a map of two states. This is Oregon here and Washington here, and the pink and orange and yellow colors in here tell us that we have rocks which are fairly young, primarily formed by volcanism, and then we look up here in the northern part of the Cascades and see a whole different set of colors. And that's because we're looking at material which came in on that small microcontinent and was added on here to this region, and it's exposed at the surface, these old, much older rocks, and then on top of that we have Glacier Peak and Mount Baker, which have been built. And so we see a very different kind of topography here in this region, one because of the type of rocks which are underlying the volcanoes, and two, because of the effects of the carving of the glaciers in this region. So that ends sort of my show and tell of the Cascades, my pictures as we worked our way north. I'm more than willing to answer questions, and I may or may not fully answer.
What's the source of the moisture for the glaciers? Say these glaciers, these little bits of glaciers.
It doesn't seem like it should be as great as what we see on the west side. I mean, it's easy to understand why we have a lot of moisture on Mount Rainier. It rains a lot more on that side. It rains enough on this side for, I mean, how much, who knows the answer? I mean, how much snow accumulates here? What's it, 300 or so inches? Yeah, 300 inches a year. So we're certainly getting enough moisture here in the wintertime to create a snowpack and build ice.
Are they seeding or holding their own?
That's always an interesting question, and it can be simply on the order of tens of years that fluctuation can take place. People who've been driving up and down to Paradise for years will say that sometimes they see the Nisqually down next to the road as you drive up to Paradise, and sometimes it's sort of the toe of it's up around the corner and you can't see it. I think in sort of a geologic time scale, they're holding their own. We're not experiencing any major recession of the ice, nor are we seeing any advance, but we see something on more of a human time scale. And that has to do with just annual fluctuations in rainfall and temperature.
I got a question. That big ice sheet that you showed at the North Pole, was anything like that ever the case at the South Pole?
Well, Antarctica is huge, the ice sheet there.
But what you were showing was like all the way from the Puget Sound across to Russia.
That's right. And it doesn't reach as far south or to as low latitudes as we saw here in the northern hemisphere, in part because there aren't any continental areas for that ice to have to have covered in the southern hemisphere. I mean, it sort of reaches out to the edges of Antarctica and it can't go any further. When the continents were all unified a couple hundred million years ago, there was a very large ice sheet that extended over much of South America and Africa, Antarctica, Australia. Other questions? Yeah.
From the view of Mars, does that also have plate tectonic?
No.
That's a whole different thing.
Mars is kind of an interesting planet. There's a lot of evidence that ice has sculpted the surface of Mars, but there does not appear to be any evidence of any heat, enough heat within the interior of the planet to drive motion of the plates on the surface. And that's basically what drives plate tectonics. I mean, it's sort of like circulation that you get in a pan when you heat it. If you heat one side, it rises and then cools and sinks down the other side. That's sort of what's happening in plate tectonics. Yes?
In just a very quick second bit, can you say why the Cascades and the Rockies are so different? That there's so many volcanoes active in the Cascades. What happened to the Rockies?
Is this where I have to confess that geologists can't answer everything? The Rockies are just in left field geologically. They shouldn't be there. They aren't at a plate boundary. So there's no reason to expect there to be a mountain range there, which is active today. There are ancient mountain ranges which aren't at plate boundaries. The Appalachians, for example, I mean, they sit in the middle of the North American plate. But they formed 200 million years ago when a couple continents collided with each other. But the Rockies are sitting in the middle of the plate, and we can't answer that. There's something driving uplift in the Rockies, but it doesn't have anything to do with subduction, so you don't get volcanoes.
You know, the little plates that make up Puget Sound, little bits of plates in northern Washington,
right.
How far dispersed were they to begin with, and where they come from? Give a range.
You can't answer that, because the only techniques that we have can tell you what latitude they came from, but not what longitude they came from. Okay? So we know they traveled northwards from the equator, for example. Well, we don't know if they were on the equator on the opposite side of the Earth or due south. Because fossils don't tell you whether they lived there or there. A lot of them have fossil affinity with Asian rocks, so they must have traveled a great distance across the Pacific. Yes?
Lava comes from a mountain like Hood exploding, right?
Well, lava is actually something flowing down. And we don't tend to get flows of lava in explosions, they tend to happen in quieter kinds of eruptions.
I just wondered why we have seen so much down at like Bend and all along the way from Colorado through.
It's different. This is the Colorado Plateau basalts. And they have a very different kind of history to them. They have a much greater affinity with what we see in Hawaii. It's this idea of a hot spot. You have this source of molten material in the interior of the Earth. Single isolated source has nothing to do with the plates, and it makes its way up to the surface and it builds a volcanic pile, and that's what Hawaii is. And the reason we have the chain of islands in Hawaii is because that plate moves over this source, and first it builds a volcano, and then the plate moves on and it builds another volcano. We had another hot spot which has made its way across the western part of North America. It erupted about 17 million years ago and produced the flood basalts of the Columbia Plateau. It's now that active source of heat below Yellowstone. So it's a whole different kind of story to make up. Other questions?
No?
Yes?
The glaciers that were over the Cascades and also over the northern part of Washington and the eastern part, obviously were carving the ridges that you were describing on the mountains and the Cascades as they were receding and shrinking.
Uh-huh.
But what were they doing in eastern Washington when they were receding? What kinds of?
Well, actually, most of the carving takes place as they advance rather than as they recede. In eastern Washington, they carved some of the landscape, but what they did in the most dramatic fashion was leave a huge pile of water. And what happened when that water was released from behind a dam? Does anybody know what that's called in that area? The scablands?
Yeah.